Welcome to Lost Ladies of Lit, the podcast dedicated to dusting off forgotten women writers. I'm Amy Helms, here with my co-host, Kim Askew.
We're so happy to have you joining us today to discuss a Lost Lady of Lit who also birthed a literary genius.
He had nothing to declare except his genius, in fact. I think we all know who Oscar Wilde is. Not only did he write The Ballad of Reading Gaol, novels like The Picture of Dorian Gray, and popular plays, both comedies and dramas, but he was also a media sensation in more ways than one. The Irish writer was caught up in public scandal, yes, but he was also heralded for his sharp wit and bon mots, zingers like, "I can resist anything except temptation."
And my personal favorite, "Everything in moderation, including moderation." He would be a social media darling if he were alive today.
Yeah, true. But Kim, I'd like to point to another line he wrote in The Importance of Being Earnest, which factors into our subject today. "Every woman becomes their mother. That's their tragedy. And no man becomes his. That's his tragedy."
Ooh, interesting, because I'm thinking about how clever and talented Oscar Wilde was, and surely that did not materialize in him from out of nowhere. Does the woman who raised him deserve any credit in shaping one of the greatest literary talents in the English language?
Well, considering she was a successful writer herself, I'm thinking the answer is yes. And in fact, despite that line I just read from The Importance of Being Earnest, I think Oscar was very much like his mother. I'd go so far as to say that she made him the man he was.
Okay, so I'm excited to talk about her, and given that she's a Lost Lady of Lit, her own writing career as well.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't even realize his mom was a writer until I was listening to the Rest is History podcast's episode on Oscar Wilde last year. They mentioned it in passing, and I was like, wait, what? I didn't know anything about her.
Yeah, I was totally clueless about this too, so many lost ladies. So who was she, Amy?
Well, her name was Lady Jane Wilde, but she wrote under the pen name Speranza.
Ooh.
I know, I love saying that, Speranza. In her lifetime, she earned the nicknames the National Poetess of Ireland, as well as Speranza of the Nation. So kind of a big deal.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, but that name was probably both because her writing spoke to her fellow country members, and also because her work was very prevalent in an Irish newspaper that was called The Nation.
Oh, okay. There you go. All right. So it was like a double entendre. Okay.
Yes.
When you say Lady Jane Wilde, that sounds like she was some sort of blue blood or nobility. Is that the case?
Not really. Her husband was knighted for his work in the medical field, which is how she gets the title. And she certainly leaned into being the lady, you know.
As one would.
Yeah. If you give me that title, I'm going to live up to it. So
yeah.
The couple, they were definitely celebrated in Dublin, and they were upwardly mobile, but her Irish ancestors were pretty much working class. Her father was educated. He was an archdeacon and a solicitor. Her dad died when Jane was 3, and she was largely self-educated, and actually impressively so, because it's speculated that she probably knew around 10 languages, and
Whoa.
She translated works from German and French in her 20s. So she was pretty fluent in the other languages, I guess. But get this, her uncle by marriage was Charles Robert Maturin, who wrote Melmoth the Wanderer. And I know you know that book and would love that connection.
Totally. I absolutely love that. That's great. Oh my gosh. Also in her 20s, she began to contribute prose and poetry to The Nation, as you mentioned, Amy. And this was a weekly nationalist publication associated with the Young Ireland political movement for Irish independence. It was basically the go-to source for Irish radicals.
Right. And this is where we see that Jane, or Speranza, as she was known by readers of this periodical, was a rebel at heart. She once said, "I should like to rage through life. Ah, this wild, rebellious, ambitious nature of mine. I wish I could satiate it with empires, though a St. Helena were the end." And so that's kind of a reference to Napoleon. She's basically saying, I wish I could be like Napoleon. She even briefly served as co-editor of The Nation alongside another female contributor after the male founders of the newspaper were jailed for treason. It was kind of a very controversial newspaper, as you can tell.
Yeah, she sounds brave and very cool. And needless to say, she wasn't just going around writing pretty ladies' poetry. Not that there's anything wrong with that, was she?
No, no, not for this magazine. Her writing was very political in nature. She wanted an armed revolution against the British. I mean, she was full of fighting words, basically. And yeah, it's probably very good that she wrote under a pen name. Let's just say that. Because she would have ended up in jail like those male editors. Her words are quite stirring, if you will allow me to just read a little bit.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so this is from a piece. It's one of her most famous. It's called... this is Latin, so I might not be saying this right, but it's called Jacta Alia Est, or The Die is Cast. Courage. Need I preach to Irishmen of courage? Is it so hard a thing, then, to die, alas? Do we not all die daily of broken hearts and shattered hopes? No, it cannot be death you fear, for you have braved the plague in the exile ship of the Atlantic, and the plague in the exile's home beyond it, and famine, and ruin, and a slave's life, and a dog's death, and hundreds, thousands, a million of you have perished thus. Courage! You will not now belie those old traditions of humanity that tell of this divine God gift within us. Now is the moment to strike, and by striking, save, and the day after the victory, it will be time enough to count our dead.
So that is very give me liberty or give me death. I mean, yeah. St. Crispin's Day speech.
She's stirring people up. She wants people to act. It's inflammatory, and it was written anonymously, and it resulted actually in the nation getting suppressed by the authorities. They wanted to know who wrote this. And so the editor of the Nation, a guy named Charles Gavin Duffy, he volunteered that he wrote it, sort of trying to take the fall, right? So he was arrested for writing the piece. But then during the trial against him, Jane stood up in the midst of it and admitted that she wrote it. I mean, it's a very dramatic moment if this really happened, that she stood up during the trial. Yeah. Like, it was me. You know, he was trying to protect her.
Oh my gosh. Whoa.
She was never prosecuted. Maybe that was because she was a woman. I don't know. I didn't have full details of this incident, but I thought it was interesting. And you can also see why she'd have a massive following. And you can see in her writing that she is an advocate for the poor and the downtrodden. She wrote a lot about famine and starvation. And again, not ladies' pretty poetry, right? That's a kind of unusual topic to put down in verse.
Yeah.
And so one of the poems that she's most well known for also was printed in The Nation in 1847. When it came out, it was called The Stricken Land, although it was later renamed The Famine Year as the title. I'll just read it here and know that when she is speaking of the stranger, she is referring to Britain. Weary men, what reap ye? Golden corn for the stranger. What sow ye? Human corses that wait for the avenger. Fainting forms, hunger-stricken, what see you in the offing? Stately ships to bear our food away amid the strangers scoffing. From the cabins and the ditches in their charred, uncoffined masses, for the angel of the trumpet will know them as he passes. A ghastly spectral army before the great God will stand, and arraign ye as our murderers, the spoilers of our land. So basically, she's pissed that all of their food is going over to England, and they're sitting there starving.
Yeah, no love for the Brits there. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, totally. No love for the Brits. Yeah. You could say that again. Although, interestingly, she would later go live in London.
Okay, so she's writing this political poetry for the Nation and advocating for the poor. Where does family life and Oscar's birth fit into all of this?
So yeah, the Nation eventually, it met its demise after being repeatedly shut down by the authorities for being, you know, too rabble-rousing. So when Jane was 29, she ended up marrying William Wilde, who was a well-respected eye and ear surgeon. And he also wrote books too, some nonfiction books on travel and archaeology. So clearly Oscar has a lot in his family that's leading him toward being an author. But so Jane and William, they were both considered to be brilliant, yet unconventional. Jane was almost 6 feet tall, so very statuesque, and her husband was a bit shorter, so they earned the nicknames the Giantess and the Dwarf.
People are so nice, aren't they?
But if you Google her, you will see a clear resemblance between Jane and Oscar. He takes after her physically, for sure. So the couple, getting back to the couple, they have a son named William, who's the firstborn. He also grew up to be a writer. He was a journalist and a poet, but also an alcoholic who ended up penniless. And then Oscar was born, and then their last child was a daughter who died at the age of 9, which is really sad. And actually, Oscar carried a lock of her hair with him until he died.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. But as a mother, from what I could tell, Jane really adored her children. She doted on them. And this is what's most important. She included them in an extremely intellectual household. So they were allowed to converse with adults at the dinner table. She hosted these fantastic salons with all sorts of famous writers, artists, politicians, and the children were present at all of those parties. And in fact, Oscar carried on his mother's tradition by creating a similar salon-like atmosphere when he was attending Oxford University. So he got that hosting element from her. And another thing I think we should remember, because he started getting published while still at Oxford, he won Oxford's Newdigate Prize back when he was going to school. So when he's starting out, he is invariably going to be compared to his mother, the great Speranza, right? I mean, he had to prove himself in his own right. And she was proud of him when he started having literary success. She collected newspaper clippings of his eventual tour of America. You know, she was just a proud mama.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
And we know that Oscar was an aesthete. He had quite a flamboyant personality, and so too did his mother. Her favorite color to dress in was scarlet. And you can imagine that scandalized the other ladies in her social circles, right?
Yeah. She loved spectacle, basically. She was a larger-than-life persona by all accounts, and it seems like she also could make up pithy comments at the drop of a hat, just like her son. At a certain point in her life, she started saying that her ancestors were from Tuscany and that she could trace her lineage back to Dante Alighieri, and it's all BS. Like, she just made it up.
Good for her. I'm going to start doing that.
She was also described at one point as making a habit of wearing a bunch of miniature portraits of her ancestors pinned to her chest, which made her look like a walking family mausoleum.
As if I couldn't love her more already.
She'd just be fun to be around.
I feel like she would. So, well, speaking of drama, we know that Oscar would go on to be embroiled in a world-famous libel trial springing from his homosexual relationship, which led to the writer's 2-year imprisonment. At the time of his arrest, Jane reportedly said to her son, "If you stay, even if you go to prison, you will always be my son. It will make no difference to my affection. But if you go, I will never speak to you again."
Yeah, so this is in regards to, he kind of had the option. He could have just avoided all of this by fleeing to France or somewhere and just gotten the heck out of Dodge. And they probably wouldn't have pursued the case. But yeah, she wanted him to be defiant. And perhaps she was recollecting back to her own public scandal and libel court case from her own past. They have that in common, too.
Ooh, do tell. I want to hear what happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this story is a bit of a soap opera, but I'm going to try to sum things up in a nutshell. A young family friend of the Wilds, a woman named Mary Travers, who was 19 years old, she was a frequent guest at their family home, and she was also a patient of William Wilde, the eye surgeon. Jane and William, their side of the story, they say she developed an obsessive attraction to William. Now, Mary's side of the story, she claimed that during an examination by William sometime in 1862, she lost consciousness, possibly chloroformed. And when she came to, she realized he had raped her. And her allegation of when this happened is actually 2 years before William Wilde was knighted for his services to the medical field. So think about that.
Mm-hmm.
This young woman, though, she continued to associate with the Wilds after this alleged incident happened. But her behavior became increasingly erratic. She tried to kill herself by drinking poison. She extorted money from William. And later she wrote a damning pamphlet, which gave a fictionalized account of her version of what happened. And she made it clear that it was the famous Speranza whose husband had victimized her. And she printed up 1,000 copies and had them distributed all over Dublin. So this is just a small amount of her campaign against the Wilds. She really went like full on guns a-blazing. So Jane is getting exasperated by all this, doesn't believe that it happened. So she writes Mary's father a letter saying Mary is crazy and she needs to knock it off, basically. And to make a long story short, Mary ends up using this letter to sue Jane for libel. And it became a court case in Dublin, lasted over 6 days. It was a complete public spectacle. Everyone was following it. In the end, Mary won the libel case, but she was only awarded one farthing plus the cost of court expenses. So you'd think that this case would have harmed Jane and William Wilde's reputation, right? Well, Jane's public reputation actually was bolstered as a result of this case because most people following it sided with her. Everyone thought kind of Mary was a nut job. I think post Me Too, maybe we might think a little differently about it.
Yeah.
It's unclear what really happened, but this is a very interesting internet rabbit hole to dive down if you have some time.
Wow. Fascinating and disturbing, both.
Yeah.
Later in her life, Jane was living in poverty because after her husband's death in 1876, she and her sons discovered that he was basically bankrupt. This sounds like a Jane Austen novel, right?
Yeah.
And she moved to London where Oscar was living and tried to support herself writing for magazines. So when Oscar was imprisoned in Reading Jail, his mother tried to visit him there. She was suffering from bronchitis and near death. Her request was refused.
Everything about this is awful. Oscar Wilde in jail is just horrible to read about.
Yeah.
And he actually claimed that he knew the moment his mother died because her apparition appeared in his jail cell. This was 1896. He was able to pay for her burial, but not for her headstone. So she was buried anonymously.
It wasn't until 1996 that she received a plaque honoring her on the gravestone of her husband, William Wilde. A few years later, the Oscar Wilde Society honored her in the cemetery where she's buried with a Celtic cross gravestone monument.
I think we should end this episode with another one of Jane Wilde's poems, because if you read this one while keeping in mind Oscar Wilde's own tragic fate, it has real poignancy, I think. It's called The Poet's Destiny. The priest of beauty, the anointed one, through the wide world passes the poet on. All that is noble by his word is crowned, but on his brow the acanthus wreath is bound. And side note, acanthus is a thorny plant. Eternal temples rise beneath his hand, while his own griefs are written in the sand. He plants the blooming gardens, trails the vine, but others wear the flowers, drink the wine. He plunges in the depths of life to seek rich joys for other hearts his own may break. Like the poor diver beneath Indian skies, he flings the pearl upon the shore and dies.
Wow, it's interesting that the poet in this verse is a he, because if you think about the griefs that Jane had in life too, I think it could just as easily be about her, be about both of them.
Yeah, totally. For sure. Interesting life and interesting lady.
So that's all for today's episode. If you're a Patreon member, get ready to put on your dancing shoes. In next week's bonus episode, we'll be exploring the revolutionary history of a scandalous dance craze of 19th century Europe, the Viennese Waltz.
Our theme song was written and recorded by Jenny Malone, and our logo was designed by Harriet Grant. Lost Ladies of Lit is produced by Amy Helms and Kim Askew and supported by listeners like you.